Hello, and welcome to our program, the National Geographic Society, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Jim Cruz, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the National Geographic magazine and website here on OWL Radio. Our first one is Interview with a Rock Star Scientist. Brian May, co-founder of the band Queen, consultant to NASA, blends astrophysics and rock music to create cosmic harmony. As a working-class youth in London, Brian May first built his own telescope. Then, he built his own electric guitar. 2 days after earning a bachelor's degree in physics, he was on stage with his band, opening for Pink Floyd. That was 1968. Well, today, May, 76, is known as one of the greatest guitarists in rock history. This month, he's back on the road with the latest incarnation of Queen, the legendary band he co-founded with Roger Taylor and the late Fred Mercury. Also this month, publication day for May's latest book, An Atlas of the Asteroid Bennu, featuring May's stereoscopic photography. I met May in 2015 when he was working with NASA's New Horizons mission. He's now a friend. We share a fascination with the stars. He earned a PhD in astrophysics in 2007, as well as a deep and abiding love of animals. He's an activist for animal welfare. I have been to more than a few of his concerts, often running into others backstage who are both Queen fans and space nerds, including a NASA official who once showed up with a copy of May's doctoral thesis. Even a special space issue lacks the space for all the space interests Brian and I discussed. So this interview has been edited and condensed for clarity. I'm betting that many people who know you as a musician have no idea you're Dr. May, that you earned a PhD studying zodiacal dust, a cloud of rocky grains that fills interplanetary space in our solar system. Why did you choose that topic? I knew you were going to ask. I was doing my graduate work in infrared astronomy at Imperial College in the 1970s, and one of the professors had been doing spectroscopic studies of zodiacal dust. It had come to a standstill because most of the equipment didn't work anymore. So they said, would you like to take this over? Once I looked at it, I thought, this is fascinating. It was something few people had done. What did you want to know about the dust? Well, very simply, where it comes from and where it's going. Everybody else was studying the light reflected by the zodiacal cloud, but we were looking at how that cloud moved by tracking an absorption line in the sun's spectrum, which is Doppler shifted because of the motions of the dust relative to Earth. We thought a component of the dust ought to be the debris shed by comets, and a certain amount of it might be from asteroids. I had this crazy idea that a small component might be interstellar, because the solar system is moving through space. But I was kind of dismissed as a crank. And my supervisor said, don't put that in the thesis, because everybody's going to laugh at you. But you were right. The funny thing is, I thought I could see an interstellar element that was flowing through the solar system, but I never published that part of the data. After all, there were big error bars on my measurements. Looking back at it, I kind of wish I had, because we now know that interstellar stuff is coming through all the time. Notably, Oumuamua, the interstellar object that zipped through in 2017. Now, there's a big lump of dust that sure didn't come from inside our solar system, and there's no knowing what we're going to encounter next, is there? Now, you've moved on from dust and are now working a lot with asteroids and other small bodies in the solar system. Where does the interest come from? Well, that's a passion, really. It connects to my interest in stereoscopic photography. All of the objects visited by uncrewed spacecraft lend themselves to 3D stereo images. For those, you need two different views of an object to make a stereo pair. And it is a very basic fact that everything in the solar system rotates, which is fortunate because rotation gives you the pair of views from slightly different angles that you need. I basically trawl the data from every space mission with a colleague of mine in Italy, and we find data to make 3D pictures. We started to get friendly with some of the teams from NASA, European Space Agency, and even the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency. And once they saw what we were doing, the word spread to other missions. Our first great opportunity was New Horizons, which made history with its flyby of Pluto. I remember running into you during the flyby in 2015, such a fun time. Yeah, watching that data come in was one of the greatest experiences of my life. We saw that Pluto looked like We saw what Pluto looked like for the first time, and we got two different views, one just before the flyby and one that came in as the spacecraft was going by. I put a couple of those together and made the first 3D picture of Pluto. Now, I've done a lot of good stuff in my life. I've been very lucky, but that was one of the best and most thrilling moments I can remember, to suddenly see Pluto, which in my childhood was a white dot, in all its glorious detail in three dimensions. It was just a thrill beyond measure. So now you're working with the OSIRIS-REx team, which sent a spacecraft to the asteroid Bennu. Now, that mission proved that stereo imagery isn't just for fun. It can be useful, too. Stereo can give you such an instinctive feel for terrain that can help you choose a landing site. This was critical at Bennu. The mission was to take a sample of the asteroid. So we were put to work making stereo pictures of every potential landing site. I think there were 24 of them. And we did it. We helped to choose the final site. And the samples are safely gathered. What will they learn by studying this asteroid? Asteroids are like time capsules from the solar system. We can learn a lot about this place and space, what it was like 4.5 million years ago by studying primordial material from Bennu. They're also a whole lot more important than people realized until recently. They've long been recognized as potential hazards. They're also possible sources of minerals. People are talking about mining them. But that's become more and more apparent, is the role that asteroids must have played in setting up the Earth for us to be on it, for the biosphere to be here, by delivering water and organic minerals. You suddenly realize that asteroids, as well as being the harbingers of death and destruction, must have played a crucial role in the creation of life on Earth. Then you develop a lot more respect for them. What are the unanswered questions in astronomy, astrophysics, planetary science that are most compelling to you now? Well, a lot of things. I'm excited about this multiverse idea. It's funny how these concepts start off as something which is crazy, and then everybody's talking about them as very normal. One of my favorite memories from your concerts is when special effects had you standing on an asteroid surrounded by planets, riffing on Dvorak's New World Symphony. I'm planning a new variation of that for the coming U.S. tour. I will be going further down that road. I love it. And those little planetoids around me are real objects. They're not projections. You're at the center of your own planetary system. That's typical of your approach to art and science. You mash up these fields. Why? And are they really so different from each other? This is central to my life and to my beliefs. I was told that I couldn't do art and science, so I progressed through school. And I was very resentful because I loved them both. I feel like the rest of my life has been trying to prove them wrong. More and more and more. I've discovered that artistic thinking and scientific thinking are just different parts of the same thing. It's a continuum. They're inextricably linked. You have to have both sides to function at your full potential. Creativity seems like another shared element there. To succeed in both fields, you must be willing to break the rules, to test new ideas, and ultimately, to help the people see the world in a different way. Yeah, that's right. I actually don't think I had that talent as a PhD student, and maybe I didn't have enough confidence to apply it. When Queen started to move, when it looked like we could actually go out as a rock group, I was quite relieved to give up the PhD. I'd already written it up, I'd submitted it to my supervisor, and he'd rejected it, and told me I had to go away and do more research. Well, always thought science benefited from me going off and playing music for 30 years. I hope it's also benefited me coming back. Are you excited about going back on tour? I'm excited, but I'm also nervous. It's a long time to be away from home, and these days I don't find that so easy. But apart from that, it ought to be good to get out and do what we do one more time. Right? Second, designing woman Sabrina Thompson is on a mission to empower women, starting with a flight suit that fits. Since 1963, when Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman to slip the bonds of Earth, dozens have followed in her contrails. Despite this, flight suits haven't exactly been designed with women in mind. Sabrina Thompson, founder of the brand Girl in Space Club and a NASA engineer, has created a suit for female flyers that she says is not only functional, but also fashionable. She says, "I listen to the women who would wear it, and I'm still listening." Her suit, meant for a variety of environments, including the International Space Station, is a blend of STEM, S-T-E-M, art, and fashion. Thompson is also developing a pressurized version that would be worn during launch and re-entry. She hopes to start a movement that results in women exploring space in chic comfort and inspires them to create what they need to and succeed, whether on Earth or off. Picture of Sabrina. Number one, flattering custom fit. Each suit can be tailored to accommodate various sizes and shapes. The form-hugging garment follows body contours, while allowing the wearer to maintain a full range of motion. Number two, an adjustable belt. The user can tighten or loosen the waistline according to her preference. The belt, which has a quick-release buckle, also prevents any excess fabric from hanging loose and getting caught on the equipment. Number three, a convenience flap. With this patent-pending feature, the back of the suit can unzip and snap onto the front, allowing the wearer to take bathroom breaks without having to remove the entire suit. And number four, a bit of flair. Patches and accent fabrics on areas such as the chest and shoulder add a touch of elegance and style to the women's flight suit without sacrificing functionality. And so says Thompson. Dispatches from the front line of science and innovation. Farming produce, darkly. On future Mars missions, NASA foresees crews growing food, a challenge as the red planet receives less than half of Earth's sunlight. So scientists are developing a plant that will thrive in little to no light, fed instead by a carbon-rich solution that astronauts can generate. Star creation in miniature. Imagine holding the cosmos in your hand. Drawing on knowledge of the physics occurring in stellar nurseries, dynamic regions of space where dense dust and gas clouds give rise to stars, astronomers Nia Imara and John C. Forbes and 3D printing expert James C. Weaver made stellar nursery simulations. The softball-sized spheres let the Earth-bound glimpse of the complex patterns that make these parts of space so special. Solar power from space. Scientists are honing tools that would send the sun's energy to Earth as radio signals. Though it was fantasy for just a few decades ago, space-based solar power may soon be reality. And a renewable energy breakthrough. Accessible anytime, unlike ground-based solar panels limited by darkness and available anywhere on Earth, even if infrastructure is lacking. How would it work? Enormous space-based structures would support photovoltaic panels that collect sunlight and convert it into radio signals for transmission to Earth. This type of space mission is one of the most complex engineering problems that we have in front of us, says Mamatha Mashirapa, a payload system lead at the UK Space Agency, which is helping fund project research and development. The mission also will be pricey, projecting to cost tens of billions of dollars. At Caltech, researchers recently reported significant progress with their Space Solar Power Demonstrator. The craft has been in orbit since January 2023, testing materials and electronics, and has successfully transmitted wireless energy in space for the first time. This is a step in a long journey, says the Cal team's co-director, Ali Hajimiri. And like any good story, he says it will probably have many turns and twists. A soaring life's legacy. Artifacts from Sally Ride's career and personal life bear witness to her role as a pathfinder in space and beyond. When pioneering female astronaut Sally Ride died of pancreatic cancer in 2012, a single line in her official obituary disclosed that a lifetime of press coverage had not. Her 27-year partnership with another woman, Tam O'Shaughnessy. The acknowledgement that Ride was a member of the LGBTQ community added another first to her lengthy list of historic accomplishments. She was not just the first American woman to go to space. More than 40 years ago, on June 18, 1983, but the first known queer astronaut. The revelation added a poignant personal dimension to Ride's public image as the intense and brilliant physicist, the loyal crew member, the passionate science education advocate. It also led some to question what Ride's life might have been like in a less homophobic, sexist world. Though Ride and O'Shaughnessy were open with their friends and family, they hid their relationship in public, especially after co-founding their science education company, Sally Ride Science, because they feared blowback from their corporate sponsors. Only after Ride's death did the public learn the true nature of the partnership, as the couple had intended. In November 2013, O'Shaughnessy accepted the Presidential Medal of Freedom in Ride's honor. Many of the astronaut's most prized possessions, from her personal telescope and academic papers to her NASA uniform, are now housed at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. O'Shaughnessy, who entrusted the artifacts to the Smithsonian, gave photographer Mackenzie Kelly special permission to photograph them. Kelly has spent years documenting what it means to be an LGBTQ astronaut through her project, the Gay Space Agency. Among the artifacts is the in-flight suit Ride wore on her first trip to space. Her assignment to NASA's STS-7 space shuttle mission came with a heaping dose of sexism after the agency announced she'd be the first female astronaut. Ride faced interviewers' intrusive questions about her looks, emotional temperament, reproductive organs, and family plans. NASA engineers even created a spaceflight-ready makeup kit for her journey. Ride didn't use it, and reporters often commented on her fresh-faced appearance. Despite intense interest about her gender and the modifications NASA made to its spacecraft to accommodate female astronauts, Ride attempted to keep the focus on space exploration. Her interests didn't start or end in space. If she hadn't been an astronaut, she might have had a professional tennis career. Though she briefly pursued that possibility, her love of science pushed her toward the space program instead. She earned a doctorate in physics, then was one of six women selected for NASA's first class to include female astronauts. After training, she helped the agency develop the spacecraft's robotic arm and also served as CAPCOM, NASA's capsule communicator, who maintains contact with Earth with in-flight astronauts. for the shuttle's second and third flights in 81 and 1982. Then it was her turn. Ride completed two space flights. On her second mission in 1984, the crew included Catherine D. Sullivan, the first time two females had flown in space simultaneously. Once out of orbit, Ride had more history. She was the only person on the investigating committees of both space shuttle losses, Challenger in 86 and Columbia in 2003. Critical of what came to be called the faster, better, cheaper culture of NASA, Ride pushed the agency to make spaceflight safe. She also steered a comprehensive 1987 planning document, now called the Ride Report, in which she underscored the importance of observing Earth from space, urged NASA to explore more planets, and considered the logistics of human outposts on Mars. After NASA, Ride focused on science education, becoming a physics professor and developing Sally Ride Science with O'Shaughnessy, now its executive director. The organization publishes books promoting science, technology, and math literacy, operates academies for school-aged children, and provides enrichment for educators. It all helps keep Ride's memory and her inquisitive, daring scientific spirit alive for the boundary breakers of tomorrow. Next, gawking at rockets. From coast to coast, liftoff fans in the U.S. are making pilgrimages to a historic number of new rocket launches. You're here for the launch? Ted Ebbers asked me on the night of April 19th, 2023, when we met on the beach of South Padre Island, Texas. The answer was obvious. We both were killing time before the next day's scheduled flight on the world's most powerful rocket. A recently retired Canadian federal employee, Ebers, 58, drove from his home in Toronto to SpaceX's spaceport in Boca Chica to watch his first rocket launch. He made the 1,900-mile trip alone, sleeping overnight at rest stops inside his Tesla Model Y. At dawn, Ebers and I were among the thousands who had gathered to see the first test flight of the 33-engine Super Heavy booster as it carried its Starship upper stage, built by SpaceX, to deliver payload and passengers to the Moon and Mars. The crowd at Isla Blanca Park on the island's southern tip, with the best view of the launch pad, was festive and diverse. College students in Occupy Mars t-shirts, snowbirds in Hawaiian shirts. It's the first and best time in U.S. history for the public to watch a space launch. There's a steady stream of rockets rising from spaceports in Florida, California, and Virginia. And in each, you'll find gawkers. They're enjoying firsthand what might be called a golden age of American spaceflight. During the George W. Bush administration, NASA started to shift from designing rockets and spacecraft to renting rides in ones created by private companies. This commercialization trend gained speed under the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations. Ebbers watched his first launch as dozens of engines on Starship's booster ignited at 8:33 a.m. on April 20th. "We saw the rocket beginning to lift," he says, "but the booster exhaust blasted huge chunks of concrete from the launch pad, suspected of damaging some engines. Three others failed to ignite at liftoff." 394-foot-tall rocket staggered through the sky as it climbed above 120,000 feet. After nearly 4 minutes of flight, Starship and its booster self-destructed, never even having had the chance to separate stages. Ever said, "It didn't matter. A spacecraft flew, and we got to see it." Well, he may be a first-timer, but no launch tourist could state their creed any better. Okay, where are some space launch tourism sites? Vandenberg Space Air Force Base in California. Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport in Virginia. And the Kennedy Space Center, Florida. And of course, SpaceX Starbase in Texas. Wallops Island, Virginia. Rockets bound for the space station. Watching 139-foot-tall Antares rockets rise from the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport, yeah, Mars, to bring cargo to the International Space Station has become a periodic bonus of beach vacations here. This spaceport is near quaint Chincoteague Island, known for its national seashore, local saltwater taffy, and island-hopping wild horses. Ted Ebers, Space Launch Tourist, says, "We saw the rocket beginning to lift. The nose seemed to vibrate through my whole body, but the cheers were so loud it could barely be heard. Launch sites that sell tickets can run out, so plan a backup. Research and scout alternative viewing locations before launch day. Be sure they're open to the public, and arrive early with all the water, sunscreen, and snacks that you need. 100K. That's the number of people who thronged to the area around Florida's Kennedy Space Center last year for the launch of an Orion capsule that circled the moon, with no passengers on board. KSC's big events will be the moonbound Artemis crew launches. The first is scheduled in November 2024. It gives you a while to plan, guys. Best for seasoned rocket chasers, Vandenberg Space Force in California. Space Launch Delta 30 manages operations for United Launch Alliance send-offs of secret government payloads, Air Force intercontinental ballistic missile tests, and SpaceX commercial flights. And finally, launch site most likely to experience a scrub. Compared with other spaceports, there's a higher chance of a scrub, a launch cancellation due to weather or technical glitches at SpaceX's Starbase in Boca Chica, Texas. Its purpose is the construction and testing of new hardware. A trial and error brings uncertainties. Prudent space launch tourists pad their itineraries to account for scrubs. Plan to be away for extra days and fill downtime with activities that are flexible enough to shift dates. Well, you've been listening to the National Geographic Society here on Owl Radio. Now, you can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio, or you can listen by streaming on your computer and smartphone. Listen at your convenience to our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Well, thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. Until next time, this is Jim Cruz saying goodbye from Owl Radio.